Good morning.
Morning.
Well, thank you for being here. And how many of you had a chance to see the movie last night? I'm just kind of, wow, great. Hope you found something meaningful from it. And you're gonna hear this morning a lot of the same things that you saw in the movie last night, but hopefully a little bit of my own reflections on it as well. And hopefully the Lord will speak to you this morning and has through the movie as well. I want to thank Rocky for inviting me this morning. It was kind of a God thing that it worked out. We're actually starting. I get on a plane this afternoon and I'm gone for a couple of weeks, and so I'm also glad to have my wife and kids here, and they don't get to come with me very often when I speak. And Brad, thank you also for being available to help this happen. So. Well, this morning, I really just want to speak from the heart a little bit, give a little bit of testimony, and share some of my story that those of you that haven't heard it at all will be a little more familiar with it, and those of you that saw the movie, maybe, like I said, take something home with you a little different than what the movie did. And, you know, I'm always hesitant, you know, when I ask people for something, I always hesitate to ask them for their time unless I really have something, because that's the most valuable thing that God's given us is our time that we can give of ourselves. And so I thank you for being here this morning and giving me a chance to share with you. So, I grew up the son of a Baptist minister and a missionary. We had grew up here in Texas, and then we went to Brazil as missionaries when I was about 5 years old, and we lived up north near the Amazon River, and so I had the chance to watch my mother and my father as they went up and down sharing about Christ with people that may be the only time that they ever heard of Jesus. And I remember thinking, you know, watching them, and they weren't certainly not getting anything monetarily or any of the, you know, the trappings of this world for what they were doing. And I learned from watching them a life of service. And I'd see these people that would come walk miles and miles and miles, or come literally in a canoe for hours to hear my father share the message of Christ and of salvation. And so then we came back to the United States. We came to Oklahoma, and you know, I continued to watch as they lived out a life of service. And, you know, talking about Oklahoma, I mean, you one of the things that those of you that didn't see the movie thinking, you know, why am I coming to hear, you know, a former state senator speak? And secondly, especially one from Oklahoma. Well, hopefully that'll play out over the course of this as well, and you'll feel good about it. But so we're there in a little town. My father pastored a large church in Oklahoma City, but we lived on a farm in a town called Okarchee, just outside of Oklahoma City, about 30 miles. And one night in October of 1979, one guy in particular came and knocked on our door. His name was Glenn Ake. And there was another guy that came in behind him by the name of Stephen Hatch. And over the next few hours, they had hogtied us all on our living room floor, laying on our stomachs, and they took turns raping my then 12-year-old sister. They sat down and ate the dinner that my mother had been fixing, and then shot us all in the back and left us for dead. My mother and my father both died right there in front of me, and my sister and I were able to get ourselves untied, and we got to a doctor's house that I drove us to. And, you know, we eventually got us on to the hospital, and we began to heal from our physical wounds. But as you can imagine, the emotional and the psychological and even spiritual wounds, you know, went on for years. Within a few weeks, about a month and a half, they caught the Glenn Ake and Stephen Hatch. They had killed two people in Texas. They'd gone on. When they found out Leslie and I were still alive, they came back to Oklahoma to look for us and found out we were under guard. So they went on. They were tried and they were both found guilty, given the death sentence. And then, I remember thinking, it's over. That this part of our lives was over and we could begin to go on and to try to heal. I'm so grateful that I had accepted Christ when I was 9 years old. I knew that somehow, though my faith was tried many, many, many times through the years, and there were times that I was very, very angry with God. I remember just believing that somehow God could bring something good out of all this. Might not ever know what it is, but I believe that God will ultimately bring something good out of it. So my sister, I went on to college, and my sister and I continued to work through the years. We all told wound up testifying 9 different times against these guys that shot us. We had preliminary hearing, a couple of trials, then they kept bringing it back. I moved away from Oklahoma on a couple of occasions and then wound up having to move back to go and testify and take that time. And this isn't intended to tell you about victims' rights, but I will just say this: the week after next is National Crime Victims' Rights Week, and I'm speaking a lot over the next couple of weeks on that, and so there be a couple of things that I relate about that. But we continue to work through this system out there. After a couple of years, I went to started college that next year, wound up at Baylor University. Like I said, went back to Oklahoma and testified a few times. I went to law school, and I remember during that time. Well, first of all, Glenn Ake, the guy who actually pulled the trigger, his case was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, and struck down the decision, they struck down his convictions, and sent it back for yet another trial, which is one of the 9 times overall that we testified. And the basis of it had to do with the fact that he was pleading insanity. So we went back and testified 7 years after the original trials. And then he was given life sentences. And in Oklahoma, there wasn't life without parole at the time, so he got life with possibility of parole. So every 2 years, he was up for parole after having committed these crimes. The other guy who did not presumably do the shooting was still on death row. So there was a chance that Glenn Ake was going to be able to get out of prison someday. So I continued to fight against these things and to worry, wonder what I was going to do. I had some time. I went into the military. Eventually went into law school, and I came to the end of law school, and I was about to graduate, and I was looking around, and I couldn't find a job, and so I did what a lot of people do who can't find a job, and that was I decided to run for office. And another thing that I've noticed is, that when back then, when you ran for office, you had to be somewhat happy and somewhat likable, and now you just have to be mad. And I don't really understand that, because I was really good at being mad back then, but I always had to cover it up. Now I found out that's what I just had to be, how I felt. But anyway, so, I remember as I was out campaigning in the Oklahoma City area, I was 26 years old. I looked every bit of 18, and I'd walk up to people's doors, and I had, even in the summer, put on the full suit and everything because I thought it made me look older. And I would get out there, and I'd knock on doors, and these people, their first reaction was always, "You've got to be kidding me." And then I'd say, no, I want to be your state senator and need your vote. And then they would take my literature, and they'd look, and they'd see my name. And I remember they'd see the name Douglas, and they'd say, "Are you Richard and Marilyn's daughter?" Or son, sorry. "Are you Richard and Marilyn's son?" And I'd say, yes. And they'd say, well, you know, if you are half the person that your mom and your dad were, you're going to be okay. And I learned so much from experiencing that, because I began to realize that, you know, my parents' lives of service also made them tremendous role models, that even though I only had them for 16 years of my life, they were such great role models, and they had so much respect in the community because they were people that did what they said they were going to do. You know, they were doers. And so I thought, you know, first of all, what great people to learn from and to observe all these years, but also, man, what a name that they created for me. And that's such a gift that I can give to my family and my kids. And you know, I don't ever want to do anything that would damage the name that my mother and my father created and then that they passed on to me. And that's a lot of what Heaven's Reign was about for me, was to pay tribute to my mother and my father and the people that they were. And so, you know, I went on, I got elected somehow, miraculously got elected to the state senate, and I remember looking around and saying, what do I do now? You know, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. They wouldn't even tell me where the bathrooms were. And I was a Republican in a legislature that was more than three-fourths Democrat, so presumably we couldn't do anything anyway. So about a year, and I remember thinking, I want to stay away from these issues of law enforcement. I want to stay away from criminal justice issues. I want to stay away from victims' rights issues. I just want to do business issues. I want to, you know, put my head down and go forward and just, you know, represent my district to the best that I can. And then about a year into it, there was some squabbling over the Republicans saying, well, gee, we need somebody else on the Appropriations Committee, and fighting with the Democrats. And he said, okay, that's good. We'll give you one more seat on Appropriations. But it's got to be Douglas, because he doesn't know anything. And I said, okay, well, I'll go there. That sounds good to me. It's a vote. And right about that same time, I got a call from a reporter one day who said he was doing a story about death row cases in Oklahoma, and that the Hatch case had the distinction of being the slowest moving case on death row, that after 13 years, it was only on the third step of a 9-step appellate process. And part of it was because we were having to repeat these things so many times. I would go back and testify because a court somewhere changed the rules. But part of it was that the Court of Criminal Appeals had lost the file for over 2 years in a capital murder case. I remember thinking, that's not good. You know, that's more of my life that they're taking up. That's more of my family's life. That's more of everyone's time and life and money. And so because I was going on Appropriations Committee, and those of you that don't know, we're the committee that spends the money, and I was actually on the subcommittee that funded the courts, the Judiciary Subcommittee. And so within a few weeks, I had the chief judge of that court that had lost the file sitting across from me asking me for money. So I remember sitting there and listening to his pitch and saying, well, yeah, it sure sounds like you need it. And then I'd already talked to my colleagues on this committee, and I said, look, I understand what you're saying, and I'm the new guy here, but I have determined that until you get this decision, you get the file found and a decision handed down, you better learn how to do your job with a number two pencil and a big chief writing tablet, because that's all you're going to have to write this out. And, you know, miraculously, within about 30 days, they had a decision handed down affirming Stephen Hatch's death sentence. And I remember thinking, I remember getting up that day and being so angry, and I walked up to my office and I called our staff and I said, look, you know, I don't know of any other, and I still am to this day, any other crime victim that's had that kind of a forum in front of a judge or a prosecutor or somebody like that that has that much control and that much say-so in their life. And I'm just in a place where I can't keep ignoring this or pretending it's going away or wait for somebody else to do something. I got to do something. So I keep hearing about crime victims' rights, and I don't know what one is. I wouldn't know it if it walked up and bit me in the face. I've heard about them for years, but I've never, I don't know what they are. So we're going to find out. And I want to know what every state's done, what they're doing, what they're thinking about doing, what we've done in Oklahoma, what we need to do or have tried to do. And I want to start doing some things in this area of victims' rights to help people. And all told, over the course of the next 12 years, we got about 28 pieces of legislation that were signed into law that affected it. And just to give you some examples, you know, the car that I drove to the doctor's house that night, our car was towed by the OSBI and impounded, and it cost $115 in total charges. I know that because I had to pay it to get my car back. And there was no provision in the law to reimburse us. The trip we took to the hospital for a few weeks in intensive care, part of that, Leslie was given what was called, or they used what was called a rape examination kit to collect evidence of those rapes. And the kit cost $500 in 1979. I know that because we paid it to, as part of our hospital bills before we could go home. There was no provision in the law to reimburse us for that. And it goes on and on and on. And so those were some of the things that we tried to deal with in this legislation. And then I remember, you know, it wasn't just about passing laws. It was the culture of the place. And there's still a lot of it out there. And I'll just give you one quick example. There was an acquaintance of mine in Tulsa whose mother had been murdered. And they caught the person that did it. They tried him, convicted him, and they were about to give what's called a victim impact statement, which is where the victim's family can get on the stand and after the person's been tried and convicted, and they can say, well, these are the impacts of the crime on our family physically, emotionally, psychologically, financially, whatever it might be. And that was something Leslie and I never had the chance to do in the trials. I think it would have made a difference in Glenn Ake's second trial 7 years later if we could have talked about, you know, the fact that when I was in college, I never went home for the holidays. I never went, you know, my parents never came on parents' weekend. I was working two jobs in order to pay to go to Baylor. All those kinds of things that are relevant as an outcome of the crime that these guys committed. But the jury never has a chance to hear. So now they do. But in this one instance where this friend called me, he said the judge is refusing to hear it. And he said, and I thought it was a law. You know, didn't that pass? And I said, well, it passed here in the Senate. I was there. I went over to the House side when it passed over there. I was standing when the governor signed it into law. And, you know, I've seen the show. My name is Bill. I live on Capitol Hill. And that's what they said. That's what it takes for it to become a law. It's a law. I said, did the prosecutor, you know, point this out to the judge? And he said, yeah. And the judge is just saying, I refuse to hear it. And you know, I don't want to be told what to do in my courtroom. And I said, well, let me call the judge and I'll see what I can do. So I called him, and that was basically what the judge said. I don't think much of your little old law. We are going to, you know, I'm not going to hear this. I don't want to be told what to do in my courtroom. And I, you know, the upshot of it is, what are you going to do about it? So I called my now friend down at the Court of Criminal Appeals, who had his money now, and he came up and I said, I want you to take this call with me. So we called the judge back. And in essentially a little nicer words, this trial judge said the same thing to the appeals judge as what he had said to me. I don't want to be told what to do in my courtroom, and what are you going to do about it? And I said, okay, I understand. You have a job to do. You're a judge. It's a hard job. And, you know, you don't want to be told what to do. And I said, now I have a job to do as well, and I'm going to do mine. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk down. As soon as we finish this call, I'm going to go down to the staff, and I'm going to file a bill. It's going to create a review panel that looks at decisions of judges like you in criminal cases dealing with victims' rights. And there will be at least one victim on that panel. probably a majority of them. At least that's where I'm going to start. And I said, they're going to look at decisions that you are making right now and going forward and other judges make. But if they find that you or any judge is wrongfully denied a victim of their right under these statutes, they're going to have the power to take away your pension. Well, well, I didn't even have to file the bill. Yeah. That afternoon, these people were giving victim impact testimony in his court. And again, I remember saying, it's not just the laws, it's the culture. It's the culture. And so one of the things that on the 26th of this month, a week after next, I'm going to be testifying before Congress. I've never had the chance to do with that. I think it's pretty cool. But I'm going to be able to do that to talk about an amendment to the U.S. Constitution dealing with victims' rights. There are 23 enumerated rights in the U.S. Constitution for the accused, zero for the victims. And so I'm going to be doing that, and hopefully you'll hear something about that. Thank you. So jump forward a couple of years, and I was taking a tour of the prison one day. I was supposed to give a speech, and I was going to be giving this speech at the prison where Glenn Ake and Stephen Hatch were both being held. And I remember I got there, and all that I had heard was about Glenn Ake was he was in general prison population now, and that he could take handcuffs, he could break them in front of him, they'd cuff him behind him, he could break the handcuffs. He could deadlift over 900 pounds, and this had been several years before, and they'd finally taken the weights out of the prisons so that he wouldn't be that strong and be a danger to other inmates, a danger to the, particularly to the corrections officers. So I remember walking through the prison on this tour, and really as much as anything out of fear, you know, that I was going to turn a corner and run into him, I said, you know, where are you holding him? And they said, well, we'll take you to the block where he is. And it turns out he was in a block. It was locked down 23 hours a day. And they said, but it's happens to be during the 1 hour a day that he's out in the yard. Do you want to go get a look at him? I said, sure. And I walked out into this area. There was a tall fence and about 25 inmates on the other side of the fence. And they were saying, these guys were all walking up, hey, I'm not supposed to be here, I didn't do it, my lawyer, you know, didn't do his job, and all kinds of things. Much more colorful language, but it was, you know, you get the point. So, but I finally looked and I saw Glenn Ake. And he walked by and apparently didn't recognize me, but I remember thinking, I remember that anger that I didn't really know was there. I mean, there had been a hint of it before, but I didn't know how deep that it was. And I began to feel it welling up. And I remember looking at him, and I looked at the deputy warden and said, I need to talk to him. And what I'm thinking is, I just want to be in the room with this guy. Just give me a few minutes. And he looked at me and he said, well, you know, only the warden can approve that. And so, you know, we'll need to ask him. And so, you know, I said, let's go see him. And we went to the warden. I sat down and I said, Mr. Warden, I would like to have a meeting with Glenn Ake. And he said, absolutely not. We don't do that. I said, okay, who's your boss? And he said, well, that would be the regional director. So I said, let's get him on the phone. I said, regional director, you know, I want to go meet with Glenn Ake. And he said, absolutely not. And so I said, now who's your boss? He said, it's the director of the State Department of Corrections. And I knew him. I met him several times. And so I said, let's get him on the phone. And he actually flew in to meet with me in this town in southeast Oklahoma. And I sat with him and I said, you know, I want to meet with Glenn Ake. He said, no, you cannot do that. I said, I'm on this. You know, I started to figure it out by now. I said, look, I'm on this committee called Appropriations. And he said, I think it'd be a wonderful idea for you to meet with Glenn Ake as long as Glenn Ake's willing to meet with you. So, you know, it came down to it. A couple hours later, I found myself walking into the room to meet with this guy. And, you know, he's no longer deadlifting 900 pounds. He's smaller, but you know, he's still strong. And so I was scared to death. I mean, out of my mind scared. But I remember it not mattering anymore. I was so angry. And I was, as I was walking towards that room, feeling again that rage that I hadn't felt in 15 years, or, you know, that I just, I guess, bottled up. And as I was walking there, I was just replaying in my mind that night. And again, just feeling like, of all of the possibilities that I could think of what was going to happen in that room, not one of them was good. None of them. And I walked in and I sat down, and I remember the first thing, you know, I started to speak and I choked a little bit, and he said, "Can I say something?" And I nodded, and he said, "First, I want you to know that I'm so, so sorry for what I did to you and your family." Well, that was the last thing in the world I expected to hear from this guy. I mean, his whole MO was to be crazy and to play crazy, and he had done it in the courtrooms. He had done it anytime there was a camera in front of him. He had done it. That was the basis of his whole appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And his new trial was the fact that he was not sane. And so I was expecting him really to come at me or do something much different than sit there and apologize. And so I continued, we continued the conversation, but I remember one of the things that I was thinking was shortly into that, and I said to him, I said, "You know, my father was a minister. He always taught me that I should forgive, but that ain't happening. That's not who I am. That's not what I'm about, and that ain't going to happen today." And he said, "I understand." And so we continued on with the conversation. And I remember thinking, the guy that sits in a cell for 23 hours a day is not used to looking people in the eye, and I'm going to make him sit here and look me in the eye as long as it takes, till eventually he's going to drop his guard, and I'm going to be able to look in his face, and I'm going to know if he's telling the truth or he's not. And so there was a point about halfway through the conversation where I remember he was wiping away tears, and he was struggling with these shackles, and he was trying to wipe the tears away, and he looked up at me for a second, and that's when his guard was down, and I remember seeing in his eyes really complete sincerity, at least as far as he was capable of at that point. And so the conversation went on, and I remember, and it's impossible to show something like this in a movie, but I don't know what he was feeling, but I remember wanting to say things that might provoke him, and wanting to get myself more charged up to get angry, to really, really let that anger go at him, and I couldn't. It was like having God's hand setting right over me. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, now, you know, my life is starting to make sense. You know, this guy escaped justice, and I went into the military, and I learned how to do some things, and then I became a lawyer, and now I'm a state senator. In this meeting, I would not be here were it not for the fact that I was a state senator. And so now is the time. This is what it's about. Justice. Justice denied. And self-help. And yet what I was feeling like God was saying, yeah, I've been planning this for a long time, and it's not what you're talking about, and it's not what you're thinking. As I just could, I mean, the only way to describe it is like being enveloped in love. I mean, you know, there's this the saying, the air is so thick you can cut it with a knife. I mean, I felt like I was encased in jello. And so I remember the only way to describe it was love. And even to the point, there was this moment where he He was talking about that he wanted to write me and to write Leslie, and his penmanship was really bad. And he said, he said, in fact, that was my lowest score. I said, well, what are you talking about, your lowest score? He said, well, this has kind of been a big day for me. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I took the GED, and I just found out today that I passed it. And I went, wow, that's great, man. I can't be happy for you. There's no way I'm ever going to be happy for you for anything. I don't care. And he told me about having become a Christian while he was there in prison. And I just didn't want to hear it. I didn't want to believe it. You know, I remember just basically saying, you know, my mom and dad would have wanted it for you. I don't care. And because I expected to hear that from anybody, you know, you hear about them, they're behind bars and they're saved. So I went on with the conversation, and one of the things that was interesting was he said that since he had been saved, he had never had a single disciplinary incident since he had been in prison, and that had been over 8 years. And I was absolutely certain at that point he wasn't telling me the truth, because I knew of an instance where he literally was getting, they were taking him to the state mental hospital. As he was getting out of the car, he grabbed a deputy's gun, fired it at him, and missed, and ran and hid in a laundry room for a while. That, in my mind, is a disciplinary incident. But I don't think I called him on it. We went on, and I kept him there for an hour and a half. And at the end of that hour and a half, I just, like I said, I couldn't get myself there. I couldn't provoke him. Nothing was happening. And so I just finally gave up, and I started to get up, and I was walking out of the room, and I went and I put my hand on the door, and I just felt like God tapped me on the shoulder and said, "This isn't over. You're not finished." And I turned and I walked back over to him, and I mean, I just felt it coming. I just felt it all coming. And I looked at him and I said, you know, my dad always taught me that I should forgive. And then I said, I forgive you. And at that moment, I remember falling back into my chair where I'd been sitting before, and I just remember feeling like my body and my head were full of water, and it was like a poison that I'd never felt, never recognized before. And I remember feeling like I could, it was such a physical experience, it was almost like I could see the bottoms of my feet open up and the water flooding out all over the floor of that room. And I remember feeling like somebody, like I'd had a clamp on my chest for 15 years and that somebody took it off, and suddenly I could breathe. I was almost hyperventilating. I could breathe for the first time in 15 years. And I got up and I walked out of the room. And the first thing that I did, there was a warden was standing outside the door, as he later told me, watching his career flash before his eyes. But I said, I want to know when the last disciplinary incident was that he's had. And so we walked to his office, and he said, you know, I've been here a couple of years. I don't remember anything, but you know, they can get a write-up. They can get written up for not making their bed, so it's doubtful that it's been very long. And we went in his office, and he picked up the phone and set it down, and he gave me a date that was more than 8 years. So he was telling the truth. And as time has gone on, I've learned, you know, and begin to realize that God was not just working in my life, and even though that was something I never expected. Always knew that I wanted to forgive or that I needed to forgive. And for years, I think even up to the moment that I saw him in the exercise yard, I'd convinced myself that I'd forgiven. He was conveniently tucked away in McAllister, Oklahoma, behind bars, and there was never going to be the opportunity. And yet, I didn't realize until then how much it was wrecking my life every part of my life was slowly being eaten away and destroyed by the level of the anger and the rage and the unforgiveness and the bitterness that, even though I polished it up really well, was there. But just as importantly, God was working in Glenn Eck's life. And He was bringing him to the place where he would be ready for that meeting one day. Because by all rights, that meeting should have gone somewhere other than it went. And had he not been at the place, had God not had him at the place where he was in his life at that moment, at that day, there would have been probably a different result. But God was working in his life, God was working in my life, and was able to allow that to happen and brought that about. And so, you know, I called my sister a couple of days later and told her what had happened. And I said, I don't know that I'll ever talk publicly about this, but you need to hear it from me and not from somewhere else or someone else. And I remember saying to her, it's not my job to lay forgiveness at your feet. I'll never be able to comprehend the things that you went through, even with all I went through, and I was there, you know, and what it's done to me. I'll never be able to understand how devastating the things were for you. So I can't tell you, you should forgive. You know, I said, it's my job simply to say, this is what happened. This is my story. This is why I needed to do what I needed to do. It was to forgive in order to begin to move on and to be able to live my life. And so, for so many years, though, I can remember being at Baylor and looking around and just so many nights that I couldn't sleep, so many nights so many mornings I couldn't get up, and was so depressed, so down, so many things going wrong, and that I looked back and I thought, you know, why did I even bother getting up off that floor in the first place? I mean, was it to live a failed, miserable life, or was it to live a life, a joyful life? You know, was it to live a happy life or a successful, whatever that meant, kind of life? And that's what it was about. And that's what God used to help me get up off that floor that night. Didn't mean I knew I was going to survive, but I was at least going to try. And that was a choice. And we all have these choices. We have these choices we make every day. But looking back on it, it was like it. You know, I chose one way, but by also choosing, whether, you know, directly or indirectly, to carry that anger and the rage and the hate, I was killing off my ability to live the life that I got up off that floor to live in the first place, which is also the life that God wants me to live. It's also the life that my parents want me to live, is a life of joy. To have a family again. And that's what He wants for all of us, is to live joyful lives that we can be proud of. To not carry around the anger and the hate and the bitterness that destroys so many of us. If it doesn't destroy us, it's at least keeping us down and keeping us back. So I pray that for everyone here this morning. My prayer, ultimately, you know, as God led us to make heavens rain, was to show that it's possible for any of us to forgive and to live the life that God wants us to live. So I pray for that for all of you this morning. And again, I thank you for the chance to come and share my story.
want to ask Brooks a couple of questions. I know our time is just about gone, but how's your sister today? What's happening in her life?
Well, she's doing better than I've seen her. She's doing great. She still lives in Oklahoma City. She is a vice principal of a school. She has two kids that are grown. I mean, I have a six-year-old and a four-year-old. She's 3 years. I told her I'm not old enough to be an uncle yet, and you know, for all these years, and now I'm finally a dad. But she's doing great, and I think just in the last 3 or 4 years, she's had a much harder time, and it's taken her a lot longer. And you know, she was involved in the making of Heaven's Rain. She plays the lounge singer right in there. Although she's really angry about that, she said, you know, she wanted it reshot because she had put on about 40 pounds from falling and having surgery and all these things. And so I said, well, you know, instead of us reshooting, it'd be cheaper for me to produce a, you know, personal training video. And you should use before. That was a before, and now is the after. So, but she's, I think the movie, I mean, I wouldn't presume that it's been what's the thing, but I think it's helped her kind of step back and get a perspective that she hasn't really had before. But I think she's, like I said, I'm just happy that she's doing well now.
I wanted to ask you as well, for most of the folks, I've mentioned this before, but you played your father in the film.
Right.
I can't really wrap my mind around the scene where you as the dad are reliving the dying of your dad as the son.
Yeah.
I mean, describe for me a little bit how you were able to do that at all. I mean,
denial that it was even in the script was part of it. I mean, as I mentioned before, when I was writing it, you know, we wrote those scenes, and I didn't know that I was going to be playing my dad. And so by the time the idea came around, the decision was made to play him, I was thinking about the good stuff, the Brazil, because that's the way I remember him. I don't picture him dying next to me on the floor. I picture him, you know, throwing a football, up preaching, you know, driving in the car. That's how I remember him. And so I started working with an acting coach, and the first thing he did was he went right to the crime scene. He said, "This is a high wire act. I'm not even sure it's ever been done before." And so we got to have a lot of things around. So Julia was there, you know, the night that we shot that scene. And every part except that of playing my dad, the role of my dad, was great, and it was fun. But when it came to that, that was the last thing that I shot. I remember we did it on a Friday night so that everybody, the crew, because it was a really emotional experience for the crew and everybody else as well. And so they'd have the weekend to recover before they went on. And it was one of the top two or three things that I've ever done in my life, including, you know, getting up off the floor after being shot. But we had people there that were supportive, a lot of prayers. I mean, I remember the morning before I shot that scene, we were actually staying with Leslie when we were in Oklahoma to shoot that part of the movie. I was at her computer that morning, and she walked by, and I remember she had been gone, and she walked by and then came back, and she goes, "Well, we hadn't really said anything to each other, but she knew that that was, scene was coming up, and she wasn't going to be there before it, but she knew of it." And she just said, she goes, "Well, I just want you to know I'm glad it's you and not me." And I remember just bursting into tears, just losing it, and she lost it. We just, you know, we hugged, and so the hardest part of it, I think there was a time, and we were having to lay there for hours and hours as they move cameras, move lights, all those things. And I remember at one point we were able to get up, and so Mike Bogle, who plays the lead, and the little family group, and then Julia and the acting coach were up in this room above the upstairs in the house, and I remember that's when it hit me that I was actually living out my dad's last few hours on earth. And that, you know, I just almost couldn't go back and finish shooting at that point. But we were able to do it. But it was just a lot of prayer. A lot of prayer, a lot of support, a lot of good folks.
What about your life in ministry now? What do you see moving forward in the direction of your life? What do you see God's up to?
I think we'll make, I hope to make a lot more movies. I think that's where God's taking us, is that movies with a positive message, and that, you know, it's, I think we worked really hard to make Heaven's Rain a quality movie in addition to me, you know, and it's not like a lot of other faith or Christian films where you're kind of looking at your shoelaces and saying, well, it's a nice story, but you don't necessarily want to tell your friends about it. And so we really want to make good movies that everybody wants to see, but that have a positive, positive story. And so, writing a book right now, that'll be finished, by the end of the year. But the release of Heaven's Rain is happening right now. So you guys are seeing it before the world, you know, gets a chance to see it.
And the book is going to be about Heaven's Rain?
It's going to be more of the story. I mean, obviously in the movie, they're so limited. And a lot of the things that I've talked about this morning that weren't in the movie.
So. Again, let's thank Douglas.